Real Business Owners.
Guys, welcome back to Real Business Owners. This is episode 14. Guys, we got an awesome guest for you today. His name is Jared Wheeler, okay? He started a car dealership here in St. George, Utah, where we're located. He started with 5 cars. Now he's, you know, gets all the way up to 250 cars on his lot at some times. Obviously, there's a little bit of ebb and flow, but man, he's an awesome guest. You guys are going to enjoy all the nuggets and the value that he brings to the table on this episode. And this episode, per usual, is brought to you by Easier Accounting. Guys, if you have any bookkeeping, tax prep, payroll needs, make sure you keep us in mind. And yes, we are a nationwide accounting firm. Enjoy episode 14. Guys, welcome back to Real Business Owners Podcast. This is episode 14. We got a good one for you today. It's Jared Wheeler. This individual has done what we've done, basically kind of come from nothing and built his business, and he's having a lot of success. So we wanted to bring him in and kind of hear his backstory and his upbringing and kind of how he's built what he's built. So Jared, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about your upbringing, all that good stuff.
Had a pretty good upbringing.
Okay.
Good parents. You know, I can't say that it was rags to riches completely. Definitely had some struggles, you know, all that stuff that normal people have.
Yeah.
But as far as the car business, I started it in 2009, so I was 19. So okay. 10 years ago in November.
So did you actually start your car business 10 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Or okay, yeah. So did you have any experience prior to that?
So I started working at a car dealership when I was 14, you know, detailing cars and stuff like that. So
nice.
And I've been around it for a long time. It was different back then. Even in my 10 years, a lot's changed. It's changed a lot in the last 2 years.
Oh, so. It's always evolving. It always will evolve. That's just business in general, right?
Sure.
And absolutely. Those that don't evolve end up getting left in the dust.
Yeah. Well, that happens. If you're looking at, you know, you talk to other independent dealers right now and they say, oh, the used car market's dying. I mean, we're selling less and less cars, which is completely not true. You know, you have some heavy hitters like Carvana or Vroom or, you know, any of these guys. And as long as you're following the trends and knowing what to do, we're selling more cars than we ever have and we're scaling still. But you can't do what you've always done. You have to be paying attention, you know, so.
You gotta keep your ear, you know, close to the streets and be on the pulse of what's going on. You guys have done a really good job of that. I mean, I can't turn on the radio without hearing you guys. No, you're good. No, you guys definitely have a whole different flavor compared to, you know, most radio type commercials, right?
Sure.
You know, you guys do a really, really good job with that and definitely bring the energy. You know, you could feel that definitely when you hear your ads.
Yeah.
So what was the, you know, a lot of people think that radio's dead, right? I mean, what's your take on that? Have you guys seen a pretty good impact within your business due to radio, or where would you credit, you know, a lot of the success?
Marketing's hard in general.
Yeah.
I mean, I shotgun money all over the place. I don't know what comes back the best.
Yeah.
But especially in our community here in St. George, it's a little tighter knit community. People listen to it just to know what's going on.
Yeah.
But when it comes to like our branding and our strategy, I guess it comes down to how the car business used to be, like a sales process, say, if you would be, you know, you would meet and greet the customer and then you would identify their needs, you know, like, hey, what kind of car do you need?
Like
then,
an SUV or,
yeah,
you
sure.
know, truck,
like, okay, how many people
for?
In your family and
gotcha.
You know, all those things.
Okay.
And then from there you would, make a recommendation, right? Like, hey, based on your needs, I recommend this vehicle.
Okay.
And then you would, you know, demo it. Send them on test drive, try and get the sale from there.
Of course.
And you guys can sell not just locally, though. You can sell people all... Do you mainly just Western United States or is it all over?
We ship all over the country. We ship...
Okay, so you actually ship, too.
You know, 2 months ago to New York, like, you know, all over the place. But what I was trying to say about how it used to be was you used to spend a lot of time building rapport with a customer.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
you could find out, hey, what are you interested in? That way I can make a good recommendation. This is how it was when I first kind of started the car business. And it was really nice. You had a lot of personal interaction. You could build the rapport. You got to know them. They you know, there's trust in that relationship. And now what happens is everything's pretty much done online. So, you know, a customer or client sees the car, they see it's the best price and it looks good, clean Carfax, all this stuff. They just show up to the dealership now with their phone and say, hey, I want to drive this car.
Mm.
And so my salesman say, okay, sweet, you know, and let me get a copy of your ID. I'm going to put you on a test drive. You have no opportunity anymore to build rapport or to get to know that customer because it's so... It's like transient. It's like you're just almost like a chauffeur to, okay, yeah, here, I'm gonna put you out on the drive. So when we're thinking about our marketing strategy, that's kind of what our goal was. Hey, I want people to know that we're just cool guys. We're just, you know, we're doing what we can. We're making sure we're the best deal. We do all this stuff. But if you listen to the other branding in town, it's, oh, we got a huge box. You know, it's just crazy.
Yeah, so, we've got X amount of cars to liquidate. Hurry, come on down.
I got to get rid of these 2018 like, late models. You know, it's...
Yeah, exactly. Every dealership has a bunch of cars to get rid of. Right?
So people show up. They know what they want.
That is different, though.
You know what I mean? They've done their research. Right. So it's not like you can... do you still try and train your sales guys to be like, dude, don't let them leave the lot? Because I know a lot of car lots are like that.
So it's different how like I run the business versus other car dealers, but like I it's pretty sophisticated as far as I know all the competition for that exact car within 500 miles or nationwide, depending on how rare the car is.
Is that something that you guys do on every car and it's like a requirement? Like I want to know what the competition is close by?
Yeah, not just on every car, but on every car every week or multiple times a week. Wow. The whole thing is if and it's funny, any of the big heavy hitters that are doing this sort of thing, we all kind of know each other and we're all bouncing, all right, there's $100 less from last week and we're all competing on the same cars until eventually gets low enough, someone just comes and buys it and then you're the lowest one.
Right.
So it's a sophisticated software that you know, can pull every single listing, like if you will.
It's almost like an MLS type listing for houses, but they have that for cars.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and it's super sophisticated to where you can know, okay, this is what the target is on this car. Mm. This is where you should be if you want to sell it within 30 days or say 45 days. It gives you all these projections. And if you're paying attention to those, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, of course.
It takes hours and hours, but if you're willing to do it, then
you should be able to be high up in terms of opportunity.
And then it all just comes down to buying, making sure you're buying at the right number, making sure your reconditioning costs are the right thing. You know, everything we've done to get to this point, it's kind of like you have to look at every process in your business. You know, in the beginning it was buying cars at the auction and taking 2 weeks to get the car here because I didn't have a transport company. Mm. So we bought a transport truck, started a transport company, and that's cool. Now we can take loads of other people's cars as we go down or back and forth, so that helps.
Nice.
Then I get the cars within a 24-hour turnaround. A lot of times I can get my first load of cars that I buy online, pictured, priced, everything within 24 hours, which is a huge deal. Time is money in my industry. And then you go all the way through it, right? So from there, you need your own service department, right?
Because I was going to bring that up because you guys went from just kind of a smaller dealership, and then you're kind of growing. Then you've added the service center. Yeah. Do you think that, you know, dealerships without a service center will eventually kind of, I mean, is that a big money maker for a lot of, you know, car dealerships?
Yeah, I don't know if...
that's what I've heard anyway. Yeah, a lot of people are like, oh, here at this dealership, we make a lot of money off of the servicing and this. You know?
And it's different if you're a franchise, right? Yeah. Because then you're getting monies being paid from, say, the franchise. Maybe like Toyota's paying you to do these recalls or whatever. Yeah,
they said they make a lot of money on the recalls.
Which is nice. So you get some stuff back. Then you build retention, you know, if a person buys a Toyota, then...
Yeah.
They can get a maintenance package and go back to the Toyota store to get oil change and stuff.
Yeah.
But for us, it's more, I mean, it's a profitable business, but it's not like off the charts or anything. It's more about controlling your time. I could do a lot better by getting my cars serviced faster and selling them quicker than me outsourcing that and saving the expense of the overhead. And there's always that limit of, you know, before I had the service center, you were getting quotes, hey, head gasket, this, that, and the other tranny. And you don't know. Obviously, you try and trust the people, but there's no real control of if you're 100% doing what you need to every time.
Exactly.
So being able to control that aspect, I don't know, it helps me sleep better at night, I suppose, knowing that I'm doing what I need to do, not that what someone's just suggesting I do.
Yeah. So with that, I mean, obviously, with how fast, I mean... You've grown pretty quick over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, right? Is what I've seen anyways, right? Sure. That means you've had to make obviously a lot of sacrifices, right? Like put yourself kind of on the back burner a little bit in terms of the big paydays because you're always putting money back into your business.
I'm glad you bring that up.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I got a lot of gray hairs for only being 29, so that's physically and mentally draining.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
A lot of people, and especially... your sort of audience, being a business owner, looks a lot prettier on Instagram and Facebook and stuff than what the reality is. Yeah. And the money looks
absolutely
prettier on Instagram and Facebook. It's not all what it's cracked out to be that a lot of people think it is. Obviously, it's rewarding and it's challenging and it's, you know, kind of what I live for now. But there's a lot that goes into it and a lot of stress. You know, there's a lot of trade-offs that I think that it's hard for people to understand or see, especially when you're trying to grow or scale, right? It's you have to make everything's a chess game. You know, it's a chess game. Absolutely. Every move I make, especially once you start getting a lot of employees, we're just to about 50 employees now, which is crazy.
Yeah,
and every single decision I make every day is
you keep all those people in mind.
Yeah, I got to think of that. Think of their families. Think about their house payments.
Yep.
You know that, and all the cars they bought or whatever it is, which is fine. That's part of life, right? Yeah. But it's definitely.
I can totally relate to that, man. Like that's always been one of my biggest stresses all these years. Is like, man, am I creating enough leads to keep my sales guys fed? And then they got their families. Or man, when I have to let a guy go, they just didn't work out. Like first thing I think of is, dude, man, what's this guy going to go through and his family? But you don't do him any favors, also by letting keeping him around if they're just being mediocre.
Yeah, I've learned that the hard way. Yeah. I was I don't know if I was supposed to be born into this sort of lifestyle because I was a very empathetic. I'm still a very empathetic person.
Yeah.
Never wanted to hurt someone's feelings or tell them no or whatever.
Yeah, trying not to be harsh.
And that's hard to be that type of person the way I was in the first 5 years or so of the business. And then I was able to kind of change knowing exactly what you're saying. You're not... A lot of times I know what the problem is or I know what they should be doing better.
Yeah.
And if I'm just letting go along with their life, am I really helping them progress in life if I'm not educating them or calling them out on it and letting them know, hey, you got to step up or else I'm just enabling you to
be a shitty employee.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? I'm not like, we had a really good friend that worked for us for a period of time and, you know, he'd show up late and this, that, the other and you know, kind of taking advantage of the situation a little bit, you know, and it is what it is. But when I finally boxed his shit up and put it on his desk, so when he came in and he saw that and he was kind of taken back by it a little bit, but it was time.
Yeah.
Right.
One of our best friends, too.
One of our
best friends.
Yes, he still is.
Family.
He still is. He's still a good friend of ours. But and now he got a job. He was actually selling cars. Now he does finance. He's on the back end where he's making some good money for himself. But if good I wouldn't have let him go, he wouldn't have found that.
Exactly.
And he wouldn't be where he's at today. He would have just still kind of been riding the coattails and just cruising along. So sometimes you actually do people a favor
100%.
By giving them that wake-up call and smacking them in the face and say, hey, it's not working out. Eventually, they hear that enough, they're going to have to look internally and say, man, maybe it is me. Maybe I need to freaking figure this shit out, you know?
That dude, entitlement's a killer.
He actually called me just like last week.
Did he?
Maybe it's 2 weeks ago. Yeah, I was out all last week. So 2 weeks ago, he called me. I thought he was drunk. He's like, dude, I'm so proud of myself. I just got I gotta thank you, man. Like, always being real. You and Trevor, he talked about it when he used to work for us, how he was just being a piece of shit. And he's like, and dude, like, I made $20,000 last month, and I can't believe it. I never thought I'd be able to do that, but I decided to go all in and quit being a piece of shit. And he basically said it was because of us. Like, dude, you guys didn't let me, you know,
just take advantage
keep getting
of the
by.
Situation.
Yeah,
I've seen that so many times. Yeah. It's if you look at it that way, like no one likes firing someone. No one likes having those hard conversations and calling people out. But that's kind of the role of a leader. That's the role of a business owner. If you can't do that when you need to, then you don't really deserve everything else that comes with it.
Your business will struggle.
Right.
Your business will struggle if you can't pull the trigger when it needs to be pulled and take that thing around the barn, you know, and put it to rest.
Yeah.
Then you're not doing yourself any favors. You're not doing the other employees any favors because I believe that. Employees could push each other, right? So if you are constantly dropping off the bottom level type employees, you're actually making the entire group stronger, right? Because you're only as strong as your weakest people. And if they say, oh, I see, you know, so-and-so over here slacking off.
Right.
That gives them the free pass to slack off. And then that can be a cancer with inside of a company.
100%. And they pull them down. We call them the bottom 27%ers, like in my company.
But yeah.
What they do is, no matter how good the day's going, whether you have a crazy you know, motivating sales meeting or something, they walk out of it. And those are the people that say, nah, we're not going to get any more leads because of the things they're changing.
Yeah.
And they try and pull down the rest of the company with you. And those people, if you can get everyone else on board to be uplifted and move forward, they normally phase themselves out.
Absolutely.
I mean, if everyone's just jiving, you can tell who that person is in your, you know, workplace.
In your organization. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I try to, you know, find two or three leaders with inside like a sales team or whatever, and then you use them as the example. So-and-so has been doing this consistently over X amount of time. That basically doesn't give you a free pass to only do X, right? And so, and people like to be acknowledged, right? And so when they see a sales guy getting acknowledged month after month after month,
like,
man, I want to be acknowledged in front of the sales meetings and stuff like that.
Yeah. Recognition's a big thing, and that's one thing I'm not super good at as maybe an owner or whatever. But and I know that I can feel when someone needs that,
a pat
you
on
know,
the back.
Yeah. And then it's just like, oh, I want it, you know. Yeah. However, they're giving you that signal, and I need to slow down and remember to do that more. But that is good counsel.
No, yeah, we were at an event in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Was it last week or the week before?
Pretty.
Mm-hmm. And it's awesome up there. It was a good time, but. It was insane to be in at the event and have them talk about the difference of, you know, fear-based type leadership versus acknowledgement type leadership and bringing people up and having the positive environment. You seem like a very outgoing, positive guy. How much do you believe in culture with inside of your company and building that structure where everybody's a team rather than everybody working against each other? Because I sold cars for a minute and a car pulls up and I'm waiting at the front door to walk out,
right?
And then I see homeboy running out of the side of the building, running into the parking lot. And
that's up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, everybody's trying to get, you know, everyone's stabbing each other in the back and trying to, you know, shortcut each other because that's just the environment that dealership created, and so it pinned everybody against each other, which wasn't a good environment or culture.
Right.
Right. And so tell us a little bit about, you know, how you've created such a positive environment and culture with inside of your business.
Yeah, that's kind of my favorite thing to talk about, really.
Yeah.
But before I say what we do and how we've kind of developed it, you got to think about how's that environment portrayed to your clients, right?
Yeah.
If that's the culture you created where it's a dog eat dog, whoever gets them first, you know, winner take all, you know, like that whole mentality, your clients can feel that. The customer rolls up, they're scared. Mm-hmm. And in my industry, especially in my industry, is such a scary thing.
Yeah.
Like I don't like being sold stuff.
Yeah.
I don't like going to Best Buy and seeing the little dude trying to sell me, you know, and
What are you looking for?
Yeah.
I'm browsing, dude, but imagine window shop.
Yeah, imagine trying to buy a you know, one of the most expensive purchases you're going to make in your life.
Yeah.
And you're all scared, you know.
Yeah.
And then you got people running out the door fighting to talk to you.
On the side, running.
Holy
like
Toledo,
literally, I watch guys run up to the side, and their windows are still up, but they're on the side of the passenger, like,
no, seriously.
Roll your window down, I want to talk to you.
Yeah, I want to make sure I talk to you first. Yeah. I'll put you in my CRM. I'll make sure I'm contacting you every day.
Exactly.
I'm sure you want to create a culture that's actually going to bring repeat business, too.
Exactly.
Even in the car industry. I know I've bought like my last 8 cars from the same dude, you know?
Yeah.
So.
And the best part about that is if you can create that, because it's stressful. It's hard car shopping, and it's stressful having to go through all the different stages again. If you can meet someone that you trust and you know, that makes your life so much easier. Hey,
absolutely.
It's time for me to trade up. It's been 2 years. I'm going to call so-and-so, same guy that takes care of me every time or whatever it is, right? But it changes the whole energy, if you will, of the dealership when the culture's right. When everyone's kind of vibing off each other and they're excited, there's nothing wrong with selling cars or making profit.
Yeah.
The way we do it's very, you know, all the salesmen know that it's the best deal in 500 miles because they're trained to see our software and stuff. So it's mm-hmm. it's a lot easier. You never feel that you're sticking it to someone because you know that they're getting the best deal that they could on this, right?
It feels good. Yeah, so they know they're not gouging people.
And then and then also how we take care of people after the fact. We have the warranty. And then anytime someone has a problem, hey, come, let's see what we can do for you. We got the service center. That's what's nice about having all the different aspects of this business. But you'll never, as a salesman, you're never afraid of walking into the grocery store and seeing someone you sold last month because, oh, crap, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
better turn around. Yeah. I'll get my
You're always
tomorrow.
Like, hey, how's it going? Yeah. You know, is everything
good?
Yeah. Yeah, and if it's not, no problem. Come see me. Yeah. And so I think that when you when your employees have that backing, and it – I have we're bringing in a lot of new people, so some people don't know it 100% yet, right, where they have like all the confidence in the company yet, but all the leaders do. They've been there long enough, so it's nice when you know that, say, the organization is going to support you as an employee. If you say you're going to do something, we're going to honor that, right? I think it's easier to have a good work environment when it's like that, and you know it's not going to be, oh, I don't know how they're going to take care of this customer after the fact, right?
Yeah.
And I believe, I've always believed that, one, I just like doing that because that's how I am. You know, I don't want to be the, I want to be the good guy. Everyone wants to be the good guy, I think.
The good guy wins in the long run anyways.
Yeah. And then I think that the customers can feel that even without talking about it. You can feel when you walk into, you know, a sales environment, if it's, these guys are legit and they take care of people, or these guys are dogs. They're just trying to get it, you know? Yeah. So I don't know. I'm a big believer in how something feels. You know, everyone talks about...
just vibing it.
Yeah, just vibing it. If someone comes onto the lot and they know that it's the best deal in 1,000 miles or whatever because they've done all the research, that's how my industry is now. And they come and then it's that dog-eat-dog world. They get there and, yeah, they drive the car. They know it's the best deal, but something just doesn't feel right because my salesman is, like, aggressively trying to sell me something. So they'll leave that day. If you have that type of environment, even though they knew it was the best deal, right? Because I'm scared to make the wrong choice.
Dude, I've done it. I've done it. Like, I don't, I tell our salespeople, people buy from people.
Right.
You know what
100%.
I mean? 100%. So, like, I might go in to get this exact car, and if I'm not vibing the salesperson and I just feel like that they're just a straight dog just trying to hustle and sell me, I'll walk away from the deal. I would rather pay $500 or $1,000 more to a car for a car.
For a better experience.
For somebody that I'm like, man, I want this guy to do good. Like,
$500
exactly.
And, I mean, people spend that on tires or they spend that, you know.
When you're spending $50,000 or $40,000, you know, I would rather support somebody that I feel like I want to support and pay a little bit more rather than, you know, reward this guy, you know, this dog that's just barking at me like, holy shit, dude. Like, I already know I want the car. Like, chill out.
Yeah, take it.
Let me go through my, you know, thought process here too, you know?
Right. That's a big deal.
And so how have you been able to do that in terms of, like, create sales teams that, you know, vibe well with each other, work well with each other so that feeling isn't there?
I mean, we have, you know, a mission statement. We want to positively impact the lives of our employees and our customers, right? So both the people that are with us and the clients. And there's core values that are built into that about all the different things that matter to us. That's how we rate performance. You know, if you go into a performance interview or, you know, to see where you're at, those are the values we measure.
It's not about the sales.
It's not about sales.
The core values.
Those
how well are you
happen.
Living up to it?
The sales, those things happen if you're doing the rest of the things, right? If you're following the rest of the core values, those things just come. So it's hard to only look at the result. You have to look at the, you know, why you're doing it, how you're doing it, almost more importantly first. You got to address that. And if all of those things are good, then we can go into technique. Yeah, you're talking yourself out of a sale. They want it and you're saying, well, come back tomorrow and we'll let you know if it works, you know.
Yeah.
Then that's different. So you create it. We have sales meetings. We have all those uplifting things. It's hard to call them sales meetings when it's you know, we're not talking, hey, this is how you're going to slam it to the person.
Rah, rah, rah.
Yeah, we're just kind of talking about the feeling. And then, like I was trying to say, the proof's in the pudding for the salespeople. If you tell them this is how it is, we're transparent, the customer's first, this is how we do business, and that's our interview process. I need to know who you are before you join the team, because if you're coming from another dealership and you've been trained just to, like, go get them, that doesn't work in our way. It just it doesn't vibe.
Doesn't
we
match
don't like
the core values that you have.
So you have to instill it, and then like I was saying, the proof's in the pudding. You have to perform as an owner, as leadership, or my leadership team has to be the good guy. They have to do the right thing, right?
Lead by example, that everybody can kind of follow suit.
You have to be able to see it to believe it.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I think some people have mission statements or whatever, and it's just kind of they have it just to have it for a website, you know, or whatever. And again, at the event that we went to, they talked about mission statements and core values.
Sure.
And they said, if anybody ever has a question, before they ever go to anybody, it's required for them to read the core values. And if they can't get the answer out of that, then there's a problem.
Sure.
So if you, I mean, at the end of the day, you need to understand the values. And so when you have that thought, like, man, what should I do in this scenario? And if it's put the customer first, you're just like, okay, I know what I need to do here.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so, dude, I think that's awesome. Not a lot of people do like the core value stuff, the mission statement. Would you give that a lot of credit to the culture and what you've been able to build?
We always had that. It was never put down on paper.
Gotcha.
Like, I just implemented that. How long have you been with us, Joseph?
Since October.
So probably like 2 years now. It's been I wrote the whole thing, wrote all the different core values and a little, you know, paragraph about what they mean to me and the company.
Yeah.
But it was always there. It just never was written down. I'm a believer of it's never – your organization's never too small to believe those things and have those aspirations.
I agree.
But I've learned as your organization gets bigger, I touch less and less customers now, right? When I first started, I could interact with every single person that came onto my lot. They could get to know me.
Yeah.
They could see what I believed in and how I wanted to change the car industry because I thought they were all dogs, like we're saying, right? And I had that passion, that belief. And now – it's harder to every time it gets passed down, say a leadership chain. You know, I meet with my leaders every Monday morning, and then they go and spread out and do their meetings with everyone else.
Yeah.
But it gets diluted to some degree, and the whole goal is to try and keep it as strong as your original passion, your original inspiration is. But to some degree, it gets diluted, right? And I wish that I could still meet every single customer that comes onto the lot or every customer that didn't buy even because I used to be able to.
Yeah.
And if all I did was help you, maybe I didn't – in the beginning, I only
guide.
Only had five cars in the beginning. Yeah. So a lot of times I didn't have the car that you needed.
Yeah.
But I could pull up things on the computer. I could teach you how to buy. Hey, there's one here. There's one there. And I was part of it and it was – I loved it. You know, I loved educating and teaching people as I was learning.
Yeah.
Because I've been every day's learning, right? If you think you know it all, then
you don't know enough. I'll tell you this much right now. If you think you know it all, you don't really know that much because the more that you actually start to know and the more you educate yourself, the more you realize really don't know that much.
Right.
Right? And it's almost like it's the same thing with money. The more money that I make, I end up surrounding myself in different circles and I realize how much not money I have, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it goes with knowledge, it goes with money.
Sure.
And so, guys, you're never, never going to be so educated to the point where you just need to stop learning. You have to always be evolving, and part of evolving is, you know, that's self-worth, right? When you stop evolving, you become stagnant and then you start getting depressed or, you know, that's the fun part of life is always learning something new and always challenging yourself. So,
right. And staying humble about it.
Yeah.
I think the person that thinks they know everything is the one that finds themselves, oh, you know, the used car world's dying. Nothing, you know,
nobody
the same
wants
thing
to be around the know-it-all.
Exactly.
You know what
no
I mean?
No one wants to buy from a know-it-all.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's true.
In terms of what your goals are, like you're shipping, you know, all over the U.S., all that good stuff. St. George, that's the only dealership that you have right now. Is that right?
Yep. So,
and what's your goals for that? Are you wanting to expand and have, I mean, it is St. George Auto. So do you plan on trying to expand and go into different markets?
Yeah. Brands, I mean, that could be, that could transcend just the St. George area. It was always when I first started, within the first couple of years, I thought the end game was getting a franchise, owning a lot of different franchise dealerships, buying them, all that stuff. You can build a pretty big network if you have, you know, big conglomerates of dealerships together, right? And it used to be more important to where, you know, you couldn't get the same financing. Like banks wouldn't give you financing if you're an independent dealer. you couldn't get discounts, say.
So some of them cater to the bigger guys.
Yeah, like, because, and I'm sure they have matrixes telling them, hey, 80% of our bad debt comes from independent dealers or whatever. Oh, gotcha. I don't know what the backstory is, but exactly. I understand it a little better now. But after you get to a certain size as an independent, those doors start getting opened, even though they tell you, oh, no, we can't. We don't take any independence. There's always a size where it's like, hey, we want you now, you know?
Yeah.
So that's less on the, pinnacle, I guess, and more so just kind of expanding what I have going. I like to diversify, like I was saying, expand the transport company, do all these different things. If you build all that network, if I had 15 trucks running, then I could just have a giant warehouse here. There is no need anymore to have a location in every prominent city because people are willing to get the car shipped. I mean, Carvana just has a giant warehouse that there's nobody really that goes onto the lot. You just buy it online, they ship it to you on a little flatbed, right?
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily that I'm trying to expand out of where I'm at. I love St. George. I think it's one of the greatest places on the planet.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to sell that too hard. Nobody else coming.
Yeah. Yeah. we're growing fast enough as it is.
Stay
where you're at, but you can still order a car from Jared.
He'll get it over to you. I'll put a little St. George sand in the bottom for you.
Yeah, exactly. We'll put some red dirt in there for you, a red rock or something.
So shipping doesn't affect the rates or the price of the car too much anymore then, huh?
Mm-mm. Not too much. I mean, you can pretty much ship anywhere for like $1,000, even East Coast. So 300, 400, 500, what's that to have 2,000 off the car that you're buying.
Totally. Right?
So it works out pretty good.
Some people I've noticed even want to purchase from areas like this where it's not hardcore snow and salt and there's extra rust on the car and all that stuff. So you probably get people who are like looking for cars in our area.
Yeah, 100%. That comes down to buying. You want to make sure you're buying from the right places too. Like for me as a dealer, and then you can provide the right inventory to your clients.
Well, some people go even outside of 500 miles. Mm-hmm. Jeremy bought his Escalade in like Texas, and he flew to Texas. He got and then he just drove it back because it was $5,000 difference.
People will do wild things for not even $5,000 for $1,000 difference. Sometimes people will drive 12 hours, and that's cool. Do what you should do.
Make a trip out of it.
Come see Zion or whatever, right? So I think that as a business, like if we're talking to business owners and I was trying to give counsel like on where I'm trying to go, I think that a lot of people get caught up in trying to learn everything and copy everybody else and doing all this research, which is good, right? I like studying competition.
Yeah, you like to know.
But at the same time, sometimes you gotta kind of pioneer your own way, right?
Absolutely.
There's some things that maybe you can come up with a better solution than there already is, right? And that's, I think that's lost a little bit today. When I first started, there was no YouTube videos. You can go look up how to sell a car or how to be a car dealer.
Yep.
I was 19 years old. I was just
trying to figure it out.
Most of it was sheer dumb luck, in the beginning. But I was being smart about learning from each mistake, right? But there's some things that I think in this day and age, you get so used to, what's the answer to this? Or how do I want to do this? And you just instantly go look it up and you have the information. And I think that people are losing the skill of problem solving or coming up with different solutions. There's more than one way to skin a cat or whatever the old saying is, right?
Yeah.
If you instantly look up how to change your stereo and on YouTube, you never learn that. I learned that as a kid by just unscrewing
things.
I cut that. What was that? I learned this, right? So I think that you have to be okay with making mistakes.
Yep.
And you have to be okay with admitting that you made a mistake. And you have to be okay with learning from that and being humble enough to do that part of it, right? But there's always a way to do something. The things that we came up with in my company, there was no buyer's guide. There was no manual to teach you, hey, this
here's
is how
you
can
build
do
a
it.
Dealership.
Yeah, you have to identify your problems, and then you have to strategize how you can fix those problems. And then it's all about process, right? Everything's about dialing in processes and keep fine-tuning it till it's a well-oiled machine. It's all running on all cylinders and you're humming, right?
Yeah.
That's when things get good. And there's always going to be you know, wrenches thrown in, and you have to be prepared for them, and you have to be okay with them because it's part of life.
That's just life and business, just in general. Like, I think the first 2 years is just that's what it's all about is just getting punched in the face, mistake.
Right.
And if you can last those first 2 years, you're going to be
earn some stripes. Yeah,
yeah, one smart sucker, and you'll learn a lot of lessons within those first 2 years. Aren't that profitable? It's just education, you know, a lot of mistakes, a lot of falling on your face, adjusting, adapting, you know, and like you said, you talked about trying to be unique. Like you said, you came from a dealership that you kind of, you know, was really a bunch of dogs or sharks just trying to get the sell, and you didn't like that.
Sure.
So you built something because you remembered the feeling that you had, right?
Right.
And one of the reasons why we own Easier Accounting is we had so many troubles dealing with accountants and CPAs. We didn't like the feeling that we got when we didn't get good communication, or if it wasn't affordable, or we couldn't get on-time P&Ls. And so we keep that close to heart, right?
Sure.
And so as we're building our company, we're going to say we're going to never lose the why in terms of why we exist, right?
Exactly.
Our job is to fill those gaps, you know, fill the holes that we saw within the industry that didn't make us feel good. And so we can come in and be unique and different by filling in those gaps. And so I would wholeheartedly agree with you to not look so much external. If you're dealing with an issue, kind of look internal and say, how would I want somebody to deal with me if I was in that situation?
100%.
And you understand how you would feel if, you know, you showed up, you did something, and people were like, okay, take your check, see you later. Mm-hmm. You're not creating a unique or different experience, right?
Sure.
And so not enough people think outside the box. Everyone's thinking inside of the boxes that have already been built.
Yeah.
You know?
And they think about a lot of people, I want to start this business because I want to make a lot of money. That's kind of the wrong place to start, you know? And if that's your end goal, if that's your beginning goal and your end goal, you probably aren't going to make it.
Yeah.
You have to start with something more than just that. Making money is a result of all
having
the other things.
Passion. You had passion
all the other
when
things
you started.
You do, right?
Yeah.
And if money's the biggest factor, then you probably will make more money working for someone that's a good leader. You know, if you want to change something or change the industry or even be a competitor in it, you got to have more than just wanting to make money.
Yeah.
You know?
I'll be honest. The first two companies I started were all about making money, man.
Mm-hmm.
And we made money.
That's the rage.
And we made money, but we also had a lot of hurdles that came.
A lot of tough times.
And I'm really grateful for those hurdles because that is what helped me realize that, like, my real true passion is actually helping other business owners, man, like other entrepreneurs. And I would have never actually got to that point if I didn't have all the hurdles that we went through. We weren't willing to adapt and learn from our mistakes and things like that. But dude, I was a sales guy and I was providing for a family. And at the end of the day, like the things that I started is like, it's because I wanted to make more, you know, but it brought a lot of,
and again, you
trial.
Evolve as a business owner, right? Like the fact that at first it was about money, money, money. I want to better my life, me.
Yeah.
That eventually changes because once you know you start making money, that's kind of a hollow thing, right?
Sure.
Like if it's just about money, money's not going to fill up your soul or make you, it's not going to just give you passion, right?
Yeah.
And so when you actually start changing to impact other people and make a positive impact and have passion for what you're doing, you end up seeing far more results.
Well,
I mean, we're at now versus where we were when it was just about money.
Mm-hmm.
It's
weird,
times
it?
10,
yeah.
Right?
It's funny, if that's not your focus, it doesn't mean that it doesn't come. But
what
it is, you know, playing chips to expand the game or whatever you view it as, right?
Exactly.
And it lets you bring on more employees, support more people, buy more inventory. You know, you just get to keep scaling.
That snowballs.
And if you can be smart like that and live humbly and smart, you can expand pretty fast. I have to attribute most of our growth to that. I haven't tried to...
You don't got a mansion on top of the hill within 3 years of owning a business. You don't have an airplane within 5 years. Like, what are you doing wrong, right?
Yeah.
That's what some people think.
Exactly.
You know?
And it's better this way. You stay more focused. I think getting early distractions, all that stuff will definitely detract, you know, from what your end goal is or what you're trying to do. If you're spending too much time doing things like that, spending money.
Or if you overspend, then you have the... Then you can't focus on the passion side and trying to make an impact because your overhead is so high as an individual that you stress about money at home.
Right.
You take from the business. The business ends up basically being, I mean, you're short-sighting yourself, right, from taking from your company rather than injecting money over and over and over and over back into the business. And I'm a firm believer of that. Yep. You know, I still drive an old truck and still live in the same house that I bought 10 years ago.
Sure.
But I'm okay doing that because I know the direction we're headed in and all those fine and lovely things that money can buy.
Yeah.
They're there.
Yeah. They're always going to be there.
Yeah.
There's always going to be a good deal.
The only thing in between me and that is just time because I feel like I'm on the right path, right? And when you feel like you're on the right path, then you don't have to rush some of those things.
Right. And you can make better decisions. It is all just a big game. It's a big chess game. And if you're rushing to make the quick buck, you're probably missing
big
out on
patience.
This.
Game.
Yeah. I love when I have a sales guy or someone in our company do some of the things I did in my early days, and I can totally train them being non-hypocritical, be like, dude, you want to know why I know it doesn't work? Because I've done it.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I can actually impact them in their sales game or whatever by saying, dude, I know what you did there. Like, I know that you didn't lie to the customer, but you let them believe something that maybe wasn't true. You know what I mean? Something like that. You know, because when guys are working on commission, like, dude, I've done all those things when I was a sales guy. And it goes back to what you're saying on feeling, man. Like, I've learned from that because it didn't feel good. And so I'm going to save you a lot of time and a lot of shitty feelings, and I'm going to help you correct it right now.
Do it right.
So some of that crap that I pulled in my early days, man, like, you know, it actually was not only a good learning lesson for me, but now I can actually teach my sales guys how to do it right so we can maintain our culture and our core values and what we believe in. So, yeah, dude, I like where we hit on those.
That's good. Dude, I wanted to ask you about the Jeep giveaway. You know, that was all over. What was that, last year?
Mm-hmm.
Or was it early this year?
No, it was last year.
Was it last year?
October? Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
So Jared gave away a Jeep. What was it, like a $50,000 Jeep or something? I think it was what I was hearing all over the radio.
Yep.
How did that turn out? How was that? How did that come about? Did it do what you thought it would do in terms of just attracting business, or what was the main thing behind that?
Sure, that's a good question.
Because that's unique and different.
Yeah,
you know.
And I've had a lot of people obviously ask me, you know, was that worth it?
Yeah.
I don't know if you can chalk it up to, I got this many sales and this many leads.
Yeah.
But it was more of kind of a shock and awe campaign.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
I wanted everyone to know that we're here. We're, you know. And I built the service center earlier that year.
So I remember that. You hung up the things on the service center. Huh?
Yeah. So it was a big deal of getting people to know and comfortable with us. I wanted everyone to see what we could do and meet, you know, the staff and stuff. That night when we did the Jeep giveaway, you know, there was, I don't know, 300 to 500 people there or something. What would you say? It was so cool. It was so fun too. And we gave away. We gave away like $2,000 cash or something too, and that girl was so stoked. She won it, and she was just like crying. I knew this so bad, you know, and that was so awesome.
It felt good to give, man.
And then when we gave the Jeep away, the guy, you know, he had all his kids there, and his wife had to coach volleyball or something that night. So he like brought, you know, 5 kids with him. I can't remember exactly how many kids, but they're all hanging on him, and he's like, I won, you know, and he got in the Jeep. That was just fun.
Yeah.
So was it worth $50,000? I think so. I don't know. You know, when it comes down to it, I have...
Certain things are immeasurable in business. Yeah. You know what I mean? You just got to keep putting your name out there over and over and over and stay in front of people.
Yeah. And it's fun to do things like that. Get people excited again. You know, there's some... Everything's so much about the bottom line, which I understand that better than most, you know.
Yeah.
Especially when you start playing on such a big scale, every day matters. You can't. You have to watch the numbers every day. But when you can, it's nice to do something fun, give back. You know,
sometimes those type of investments, man, are like you do them because you want to do them. You do them because you're not looking for an immediate return. You're being authentic about that. Yep. But in the long run, it does come back.
Yeah,
because people feel that, and people are like, "Dude, I love this dealership." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I mean, out of those 300 to 500 people, maybe not 100 of them bought that month year even, but over the long run, dude,
six months later, or a year later, you never know. I always say the work that you put in now will show face in a year.
Sure.
You know, it's usually just never an immediate result. But so you started with 5 cars. How many cars are you guys up to now?
So we float, we sell quite a bit of cars. So we float in between 175 when we've sold a lot of cars that week to like 250. Mm. And then so everything's kind of, I have a staging lot where transport drops them off.
Yeah.
You know, you got the whole lot tech team runs, grabs them, brings them to service, takes pictures. You know, we do all the things. Yeah. So it just floats around there. I'm trying That's to awesome. Get up to 300, and it's super hard. Like, just to keep up with how many cars we're selling. So
what's
I'm
the hard part to keep, like, in terms of bringing new inventory, yeah. constantly keeping your eyes on
more. Yeah, we have more, a super more. Strict buying process because...
Because you want quality.
Yeah, and time, right? So without getting into too much of the minutiae of my business, but this is good to understand, break down, you know, if other business owners are listening to, you have to think about all the different processes. Everything that we wanted to do that changed how we're operating is time, right? In my world, we're always beating the clock. If the car books for 14,000 today, next week it could be 13,700, right?
Because everyone's reducing their prices too.
That's just everything's depreciating, everything's going, and you have to be competitive. So if you can buy a car, get it for sale quicker than your competition, you're ahead, right, to some degree, and you can make maybe more profit. Depends.
That's true.
But the quicker you can get those things, the better. So when I'm buying cars, you're trying to buy things that, you know, aren't going to take a lot of time in reconditioning, right? If I have to totally rework a hood and paint it, and it's going to be out in paint for 2 weeks,
I don't see any hoopties on the lot when I drive by.
No, no, yeah.
You guys seem like you guys have a lot of clean cars.
Sure,
you
know? And that goes with buying smart first, right? That's the first start. Like when we talk in leadership meetings, that's always phase one. That's where the story starts. If you buy the wrong inventory, it's extremely hard to sell. You're going to sit on it. It's going to age. You're going to have to take a loss on that, or you know, however it goes.
So when you take a loss, that just means sending it back to the auction and taking a $500 or $1,000 hit on a car sometimes?
Or just lowering it to so low that someone online is just like, yo, I'll go buy it up. But you can still lose money.
Yeah.
When I first started, you know, I still have a lot of... old car buyers, not old like age, but like from the old ways, you know, come in, want to negotiate all hard. There isn't $4,000 spread in cars anymore.
Yeah.
And I hope everyone listening to this believes me on that.
Yeah.
We're selling cars at $300 profit sometimes, maybe $800 if we're lucky. Yeah. I'm averaging less than $1,000, and that's selling sometimes $50,000 units. To put $50,000 of my own money out and then only make, say, $800. That's not that great of a return.
Yeah.
You know? So you're playing this game of just trying to refine your buying process over and over again until you're getting cars that move quick, are the most profitable for what they are, and you keep going. You know, that's the whole thing. If you're holding out for, you know, I buy that $50,000 truck, it books for 60.
Yeah.
Oh, I can make 10 grand on this thing, right? Well, you're going to sit on it for 120 days. And then that book that was $60,000 now is 49.
Yeah.
And now you just lost $1,000 where you could have made 500 or 800 bucks, right?
So very fast if you would have just priced it right out of the gate.
Right.
You know, what's the soft spot, I would say, maybe in the car dealership world? Is it like the best cars that move, is at like a $20,000 to $30,000 range because of the average income? You know, I've heard that some dealerships don't like the high end cars because they sit there for a long time because there's less high end buyers, right? You know, and then you've got the buy here pay here's that do the $3,000 to $5,000 cars, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, you're not over there selling Lamborghinis, but you're not selling buy here pay here $3,000 cars. So you know, you've got a great looking lot. All the cars look basically brand new when you drive by, you know. So you guys do a great job of, you know, how you have your lot set up and how the cars look, all that stuff. I mean, when I drive by, I'm always peeking over seeing the inventory and what you got.
We'll hook you guys, you up, you know what I mean?
You get some Teslas over there and all that.
Yeah, we like Teslas.
So
that's my best reconditioning. Like, I look at all the numbers, you know. And I only have to change oil on a Tesla, obviously.
Yeah,
this is an electric car. So if you look at average reconditioning, my Tesla's tires is pretty much the only thing I have to do. Maybe control arms or something like that. But they're super low recon, which helps get them out quicker. That helps the bottom line, all that stuff. But yeah, I think that the best inventory is just the one that moves the quickest, whether it's a $10,000 car or a $30,000. It just depends on what competition is. That's how I'm not saying that's, if any other dealers are listening, do you, because I'm not doing what I don't know the right answer to that, but what we're doing is I just want to make sure I'm the best deal, and that's most of the time it's the best price, it's the lowest price, right? But sometimes the best deal is not necessarily the cheapest price, it's the best value, right? If a car is got 150,000 miles and it's only $8,000 versus mine has 80,000 and it's 10, what's the better deal? That's where I'm trying to fit into the puzzle, right?
So you're not necessarily looking at a specific price point. You're looking at competition, you know, being competitive with your pricing, all that good stuff, and trying to make money in volume rather than, you know, gouge 10 people a month and try to make the same amount of money versus selling 50 cars in a month and making your profit.
It's better this way. I can pay, the salesman can make less commission, if you will, like, because we're doing more sales, right? So you're not trying to like rip anyone's throat out or whatever, and we're just doing volume. You get everything starts changing when you get to that point as far as how the lenders look at you. I can get deeper deals bought, people with credit that I couldn't have ever got bought outside. Now we do, you know 50 deals a month with this credit union. Hey, I'm gonna give you a couple, you know. And so it's, there's a lot of things that start going into it. You got loan to value to consider on the cars. You want to know how much spread you have in them just to get people financed. First time buyer cars, they want to be, you know, within 10 years under 100,000 miles. So you're constantly kind of juggling your product, my inventory. I want to know how many I have in each category. I want to know, you know, am I super heavy on 30,000 and higher units right now? I want to have lower than that. Okay. I have a certain amount of number. Like
it's almost like an internal portfolio that you have of like price points and stuff, trying to make a lot of options available to anybody that comes in.
And I try and keep track of all the analytics of, hey, this sort of car sells every time within 20 days if I'm at the right price. Well, then I can lower my profit if I know I'm going to sell it within 20
days. You're pushing quick,
right? Yeah, because it's low risk. Hey, I'm only having my money out there for 20 days versus 120 days, where I could do a lot with my money.
That money over and over and over. Yeah. If you're selling the car that pushes in 20 days, you can sell that 4 or 5 times over rather than sitting on one.
Right, and... I took more market share. I gained more customers. They get used to using the service center. Like, the story just works.
Yeah.
And it works better that way when you're giving good deals, good value, all that stuff.
Would you advise maybe a smaller dealership to evaluate whether or not they should bring in a service center in terms of, you know, one, being able to get more customers in terms of selling cars, as well as maybe an additional revenue piece? Or, you know, I mean, is there a right time to think about that? Is there, you know?
I would evaluate what your goals are. Because as far as profitability, I could probably have been just as profitable keeping it on a smaller scale, less employees.
Yeah.
Right now, the service center's overhead's huge, right?
Yeah.
But it's a huge, it brings in a lot of revenue, but it's still a huge overhead. So if you're looking at profitability and all those things, if that's kind of what is driving you, especially in the early days, right?
Yeah.
That's a big deal, having cash flow. I would try and get there if your goal is to be doing a volume. But if you're just trying to keep overhead low, I just want to do, you know, sell 20 cars a month.
Yeah.
I want to have two salesmen and me.
Which is fine.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, sometimes small and profitable is good.
Sometimes that's the better way to go. And it's less stressful. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, having to figure out, you know, $200,000 worth of expenses that you got to figure out in 7 days, you only have $2,000 of expenses. You can deal with that. But when you're on a huge scale, that's stressful.
A lot of moving parts.
It's so many moving parts.
Yeah.
So I would just counsel in any business, not just my industry.
Yeah.
Grow as fast as you can control, because if you're growing, it's always good for expansion. It's always good for growth.
Sometimes quality goes down, though, with growth.
You have to be able to control every aspect. And that happened to me. I grew when I built the service center, when I expanded. I have the three different locations. The one is where we house all the cars.
Yeah.
It's hard to control that many moving parts unless you have the right leadership in place to do it. And it was tough 2 years ago when I first did that. And I was stretched so thin. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Looking back at it now, I'm glad we did all the things and I did that. And now we're here and I feel so much better. But in the moment, I was like, no, I want to go back.
Yeah.
I want to go back to when it was just me and a couple guys.
Let's tear down the service center. That's going to be more room for cars.
Yeah.
We're just going to just...
So I don't know. I would just be smart about expansion.
Of your goals.
Yeah. Just know what you want to do. If that's the game, then...
then play it.
Then play. Good luck. Yeah. You know, it's tough.
No, I agree. So just to kind of wrap up here, any advice to somebody that either wants to be an entrepreneur or a business owner or a young entrepreneur and business owner, you know, that might be going through some of the struggles, what would you say to somebody like that? Maybe what would you have you hoped somebody would come to you on year one or year two and maybe drop a nugget to you and say, sure, hey, man, you know, you're going to deal with a lot of shit, but, you know, what would you give in terms of advice there?
That's a good question. I think if we're talking about a young entrepreneur trying to start something up.
And I don't mean young as in just an age. I mean just in the entrepreneur. New to the business game. Yeah. I mean, you could be 50 and start a business. But
sure. Young is it's all relative, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I feel 60, so whatever.
Yeah. It depends on the day, right?
Exactly. So, especially when I'm wakeboarding or something. So I would say, like, I don't really do social media and all that stuff. I'm just trying to get into it. Again, I got a marketing director that's counseling me to do those type of things, right? But when I first started and all this time, now that I'm on there, I don't know if it's always been like this, but how many things are flooded at you saying, hey, listen to me, how I can tell you how to make money real quick, bam, boom, bam, whatever. Yeah. I see that, and I don't even look for it. It's just in my face.
All the time.
And I've watched maybe 5 of them, like, since I've been, like, on social media just in the last 2 weeks, you know?
Right.
And they're such a joke. Don't listen to guys trying to sell you some marketing scheme. Listen to
quick
real people. Yeah.
Get rich quick bull crap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Find mentors in the field that you want. Study mentors in the field that you want. If it's a car dealership or if it's a retail store or whatever you're trying to do, find out what the competition is out there and see if you can make it better. Because if you can't make it better, That's a hard road.
Yeah,
you can do it, but that's a hard road is what I'd say. So make sure you're starting your business or your goals with the right mindset. Like we were saying earlier, if it's just to make a lot of money, I would check that before you go, like, borrow money from family or whatever you got to do to start it, because you're starting in the wrong spot. Yeah. If you're finding a problem and you want to create a solution for that, that's a nice place to start. Then find out what your competition's doing and then figure out how you can do it better. And like I was saying, there might not be YouTube videos or how-to tutorials of how to do something better. But listening to things like this that are uplifting, and because there are hard times. And I love being inspired. It was more for books for me back then. But, you know, YouTube or podcasts, all the new stuff that the youngins are doing or whatever are out there, that's all good. But don't listen to fake people just trying to sell you
the
on
dream.
Something.
Yeah. That's such great advice.
Yeah. I don't know.
No, it really is. No, I mean, books are still great too. Yeah. But I mean, honestly, that's just such great advice to finish up the podcast. But if you haven't pulled a ton of great nuggets out of today's conversation from you, there's a lot of great insight in there for any business, not just the car
I
business.
Would agree.
So I super appreciate you.
Yeah, if you didn't come out any nuggets off of this.
Yeah.
Now, when it finishes, go hit replay and actually listen.
Yeah.
Because you'll definitely
listen
find value
and
in
hear,
the podcast.
Right? Like, really take it in. There's a lot of great nuggets in there. So,
guys, I know for a fact you enjoyed this episode. Jared did a great job and brought a lot of value. Make sure that you guys take a moment, leave a review. Check us out on YouTube. We did get that YouTube channel set up about 2 weeks ago. We see some subscribers, you know, coming through, but we definitely want to make sure that you guys get a visual for the people that want to watch the videos versus just listen to them. And make sure that you tell a friend or a family member about the podcast. And anytime that there's something that's positive or something that impacts you, you should be on the top of a mountain, you know, yelling it to anybody and everybody. You should be an individual of impact. And the way to do that is when you find something that brings you value is to talk about it with other people. So, guys, hey, kick ass. Have a good rest
of
your day.
Before we finish.
Uh-oh.
Before we finish.
Kel's going to drop something.
Jared's a super solid dude, man. So if you're looking for a car and you want it shipped
well
to you want good cars from a good area, like, I want
Saint
them to know
George
how to find you, man.
Yeah.
And go support his social media. If he's starting to jump in and market
Follow
yourself
me.
On social media.
I don't know if my life's interesting, but I'm happy to have followers or whatever that
is. Where would they find your guys' website if they wanted to check out your inventory?
It's stgeorgeautogallery.com is our website.
Okay.
Yep.
Dude, I like to throw those plugs out in our show because
dude,
we only bring solid dudes on here. And at the end of the day, like, dude,
not a pro at this. This is episode 14. You know, well, Kel came in with the save.
Well,
know?
Dude, I mean, honestly, if you're in the market for a car and you want something quality, like we said, we see dude, good cars over there. So check them out because they can ship to you and you could probably save a little bit of dough.
Sure.
So,
appreciate that. Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Now you can kick ass and have a good day. All right.
Take care. Good.